This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
It's that time of year again. My schedule is packed with bracket-busting, three-point shooting, nonstop basketball action. I don't want to miss a second of it, and I find myself staying up late to catch all the action. I can't be dragging the next morning. That's why I go for a 5-hour energy shot. They're perfect for my days packed with back-to-back games or when my favorite team is playing late. With over 15 flavors to choose from, like watermelon, tropical burst, blue raspberry, peach mango, and more, there's a flavor for everyone. On their website, you have the option to build your own 12-pack or 24-pack and have it delivered right to your door. And if you're out and about, you can always pick up a 5-hour energy shot at your local grocery or convenience store. They're everywhere. 5-hour energy keeps me going during the broadcast and the next morning when I need to get myself up and to work. Visit 5hourenergy.com for great deals and to stock up before the next tip-off.
Hey everyone, quick shout out to Whole Foods Market. You know I'm all about eating fresh and finding quality ingredients, and that's exactly what Whole Foods delivers. Whether you're grabbing organic produce, high quality meats, or just a quick healthy snack, they've got you covered. Plus, they're all about sustainability and supporting local farmers, which I love. Next time you're grocery shopping, check them out. You'll taste the difference. Spring is the perfect time to refresh your table, and Whole Foods Market has everything you need. Hosting brunch? Picture this. Flaky, buttery quiche, crispy bacon, fresh berries, and of course, cold-pressed orange juice to brighten up your morning. And if you're in the mood for something fizzy, check out their seasonal Italian sodas. Berry Blend and Orange Hibiscus are total must-tries. So whether you're planning a casual get-together or a full-on feast, Whole Foods Market has you covered. Make Whole Foods Market your destination for all spring gatherings.
I do think we're going to win more games than we did last year. Unfortunately, there are going to be some growing pains along the way that at times is going to challenge your emotions. But that's part of the development of some of these players. We need to be patient. And it's hard to do in professional sports because we've got so many competitors out there, on the field on a daily basis. But I do think that it's going to be there's going to be plenty of exciting stories. And a lot of that has to do with the talent that's going to work their way to the major leagues this season.
The premier baseball show in Chicago, Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
That is Chris Getz right there. And he's hoping that what he's doing on the big scale, some of the big changes are going to manifest in White Sox improvement as an organization this year and beyond. It is Matt Spiegel here with you on a Sunday morning. Good morning, everybody. It's just after 10 o'clock. We've been doing Hit and Run for all of 1 hour of 2025. Lots of hours, lots of shows to go. The baseball season is just about upon us. And I'm wondering from you, the White Sox fans, if you have the capacity to believe in what Chris Getz is doing, and I guess it would have to start with you even opening your mind and allowing yourself the opportunity to believe. Like, there are so many reasons to just sit in the negativity and not even get there. Like, you have to zoom out and think about some of the holistic changes to the organization. Do you even want to? I don't want to talk about this with you guys because there's some stuff that has been done. It is undeniable some of the things that have been done. Of course, it doesn't mean that necessarily things will work. But imagine that you were taking over an organization as moribund as the White Sox, an organization that had gone through a rebuild and done it with some specious reasoning, some specious team building that didn't all pan out. But it did work to an extent. You won a division. You found yourself in the playoffs and ready to battle. You fired a manager and brought in a manager that really catapulted the vibes and the chemistry quite a bit. And then some of the important pieces that you got eventually showed themselves as not worthy of the station that they were given, not worthy of the contracts that they were given. And your core eventually revealed itself as not good enough. And oh, by the way, the fundamentals of how you do things revealed itself as not good enough. So now you're in another rebuild again, and it feels soon, and it's a big, big, big ask. And that's the undercurrent of all White Sox conversation, is just the magnitude of the ask of the fans' patience. And I wondered if you've even allowed yourself to look at some of the stuff that Chris Getz has done. Here's an example, okay? Here's an example. He formed this committee last year in the second half of the year with the former Navy SEAL leadership expert who he brought in to look at the entire organization, to look at the way they did absolutely everything. And after this committee looked at everything that they were doing as an organization, some recommendations were made, and Jeff Passan wrote about this quite a bit last year, and I reported on this quite a bit last year in October, so maybe it got lost in the Bears season, and it got lost in some apathy for the White Sox, but there was a massive amount of changes that took place. An incredible bulking up of the analytics department. The analytics department rebranded as research and development, which made it more digestible for some people in the organization, right? And an expansion of that department, a rebranding of that department, and members of that research and development team reassigned to work closely with other departments, departments like scouting and player acquisition and player development. What this process did is help the White Sox rise up from the very floor of MLB in terms of how they did some things internally like this. It has created genuine synergy in the organization that was not there. It was not there under Kenny Williams. It was not there under Rick Hahn. Rick did some things and changed the way they did some things, but it was a big bus. It made a slow turn, and the turn is still taking place. And now Chris Getz has done some things like this, which maybe sound really boring to you. They sound corporatized, but trust me when I say that the best organizations function like this. That when the Dodgers need to acquire some players and they're thinking about acquiring some players, all of their analytics is already integrated. They can talk from one department to another. When, you know, an organization like the Red Sox or the Yankees or the Astros has a manager who says, you know, I want to think about this particular strategy and whether I should be doing it more often, he can just go to the analytics department or the R&D department. Or he's got somebody that's already assigned that he can say, hey, would you look into this and help me with this and give me everything that we have on this? This kind of basic synergy is a must to function well. It's a must. Do you care about stuff like that? Do you have the capacity to care about stuff like that? One of the things that they did after the very active changes that took place once that committee had made its recommendations is they created an entire new international scouting group. David Keller hired away from the Mets, and he was given full-on carte blanche to set up whatever he wanted to set up with the way that the White Sox have been doing international scouting and international development. And he's done that. He's got a big team. The team continues to grow. And so what you have is you have Chris Getz hiring people that he thinks can be good at their jobs and then letting them do their jobs. And it's some of the basics, but it's been happening. I mentioned Brian Bannister in charge of pitching and Ryan Fuller in charge of hitting. And these roles that didn't even exist under Rick Hahn and all previous regimes. I mean, Mike Shirley has been the director of amateur scouting since 2019. If you look at the White Sox drafts and compare them to the last 5 years of White Sox drafts, last 10 years under Nick Hostetler, before that under Buddy Bell and more, there's a lot more success already in these drafts. You may not feel it manifesting on the big league level as fast as you want. I understand. But Garrett Crochet is a Mike Shirley pick. Absolutely nailed that pick. And sadly, they had to deal him away, but they turned it into a bunch of players. We'll see if it's any good. But he drafted Hagen Smith, and he drafted Noah Schultz, and he drafted some people lower on in rounds like Sean Burke, you know, like who are going to have useful roles. He found some depth. There is some depth in this system. It's not just top heavy like it was in the early heyday of Han when we were touting, oh, look at him, what he's doing. So look, there are people that have been hired that seem to be pretty good at their jobs, and those give me a little bit of enthusiasm. And I'm wondering where you are on it and if you have anyone, any room to find yourself buying in. To the Score, callers, we go at 312-644-6767. Kevin in Palatine is on Hit and Run on a Sunday morning on the Score. What's up, Kevin? Good morning.
Hey, good morning. The answer to your question is zero. Zero faith, zero buying anything regarding Chris Getz. Is a zero.
Okay.
He built this whole thing. He was hired because he was the cheapest, easiest person for Reinsdorf to hire. And I get it. We get all the seashells and balloons about Hagen Smith and Noah Schultz. And guess what? One or both of them most likely will be hurt as every other pitcher gets. And when we talk about, oh, well, look at what the Dodgers do. But the Dodgers are also starting out with a $800 million DH and three of the top 10 offensive players in the league. So I'm sorry, I don't buy a word of any of this. And until they're out of the wilderness and they actually show on the major league level, I don't want to hear Sean Burke. Give me a freaking break.
All right, hang on, Kevin. No. Kevin, hold on. I'm clearly, let's have a conversation because I always appreciate your passion. I'm clearly talking about the holistic changes and the overall build from nothing. Because they are nowhere with nothing. When you start talking about an $800 million DH and you start talking about major league talent, there's no way, there's nothing to believe in Chris Getz about. But we're not talking about that. Hold on.
Hang on. Then let's talk.
Okay. I'm making one more point here. Okay. So the thing is, he absolutely was hired as the easiest option, absolutely was hired as the cheapest, easiest option without a search at all. But since he's taken the job, he's done some things that I think are intelligent and forward moving. So I can see some of that, even acknowledging that it was a ridiculous, insular hire in White Sox tradition.
Okay, but we've also heard this before, so hear me out. Yoan Moncada, Michael Kopech, the number one farm system in baseball, this rebuild, and everyone couldn't wait, and Tim Anderson was changing the game, and they won one freaking playoff game in their whole window. And we want to sit here and believe this guy with a $60 million payroll with no superstars and no one's coming here, and we can all have the Matt or Justin Ishbia and the 78 and all this nonsense. It's not true till it happens. So all this seashells and balloons, it's a 120 loss team. It's the Titanic, and the captain of the Titanic is running the whole thing. And until he proves otherwise, it's all seashells, balloons, and nonsense.
Understood. Thank you, Kevin. Thanks for calling. Kevin exists in the now, and the now is freaking miserable. I totally understand. This team is bad. This big league team is bad. I'm taking the opportunity here in the middle of March, before the season actually begins, to point out some things that are legitimate reasons, in my mind, to think that they may be headed in a good direction. But boy, it's a huge ask, and they're going to stink this year. They're absolutely going to stink this year. I do want this place to be a place where White Sox fans can be given the opportunity to learn and believe. And not just from me, but from people. I want to get Bannister on. I want to get Ryan Fuller on. I want to get Mike Shirley on. I want you to hear from some of these people. And I want you to think about whether they know what they're doing or not. And I want you to ask to look wider and zoom out again. I know it's exhausting, but that's the only way you're going to possibly find some joy. Now, if you're not interested in finding joy and would rather just live in the misery of it, That's your choice. This is David in Central Wisconsin on The Score. Hello, David. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you so much for taking my call.
You got it.
Look, I have a couple of points, but let me go back to when Getz was in the room at the table with Rick Hahn and Williams. I think the reason he was hired so quickly is he was in disagreement with what they did, and I think Jake Berger being traded is one of those things. So that's why it was easy for them to hire him, because he had those notes on his tablet and was the voice of reason and probably never won an argument.
Is this informed at all, or is this your particular fan fiction of what you think might have been going on, David?
Well, there has to be a reason that they hired him right away.
Okay, see, here's the problem. Like, I think the reason that they hired him right away is that he was right there in front of them, and maybe he did offer Jerry some of a different perspective, but I can't defend the hiring process for one second. I thought the hiring process was brutal. They didn't bring in anybody. He was basically fait accompli when Rick and Kenny were sent away. And then over the course of a month or 6 weeks, he was being given the job. The truth is that Jerry has let this thing decay in terms of who he listens to and how he listens and the decisions he made to a really unfortunate place. The only hope that I can possibly find is what has been done since Getz took the job. I can't defend the process, and I can't give in to your fan fiction in terms of the process and the hiring. But I can look objectively at what he's done since he got the job and see some good things. I can also see some bad things. I mean, what they got for the three-team, eight-player deal in which they gave up Kopech and Eric Fetty and more, and Miguel Vargas is the big, big star of that. Vargas needs to have a year, man. He needs to have a year, needs to have a career for that thing to pan out at all. As good a signing as Eric Fetty was, as great a find as he was, that's how bad the trade was so far that sent him on his way. So let's call things what they are. I like some of the holistic changes, the organizational changes. I hate some of the trades. That deadline deal, man. And then to watch Kopech be as good as he was, whew, very disappointing. So I have a hard time. Embracing all of it, but I'll embrace the stuff that I believe in. This is Robert in Wisconsin on The Score. Hey, Robert.
Hey, Matt. I got a little bit of faith in Chris Getz, because for my entire lifetime, the White Sox have always been a very haphazard organization. From the time Bill Veeck owned the team, and now since Jerry owned the team, they didn't value their prospects except for Harold Baines when Bill Veeck drafted him. Everybody else has been, you know, they'll do pretty good at developing pitchers, not so much hitters, as we see now with the White Sox. They got a whole bunch of pitchers and not many hitters. Chris Getz has kind of taken the approach, I think, more of the Tampa Bay kind of model, where they want to kind of develop their own and hopefully bring these kids up from the minors. You know Jerry's not going to spend any money because he doesn't believe in free agency. So Chris Getz is going to have to do this with trades and development, much like Tampa does. It's going to take a while, but I think the White Sox are on the right track because they actually brought people into the organization that know how to scout better than just in Cuba. And hopefully they'll be able to pull some kids out of some of these trades for some of these veteran guys that they'll probably trade off at the trade deadline and, you know, get the minor league stocked, and you'll be able to have a decent team maybe in about a year or two.
Thank you, Robert. Appreciate the call. Yeah, we're talking about 26 and really 27 in terms of decency on the big league level. And I know that sucks when you like to go to games, when you like to watch games. It's freaking brutal. I understand. But the truth is that the farm system's in really good shape right now, and it's actually way deeper in a different way than it was when Han was here. And you'll see some stuff on the big league level that shows you some possibilities, you know? It shows you some of the draft success. You'll see Jonathan Cannon in this rotation. You'll see Davis Martin in this rotation. Hopefully at some point this year, you see Noah Schultz and Hagen Smith, maybe Grant Taylor. Those three guys are feisty. Schultz and Smith are the real deal. Those are the top two left-handed pitching prospects in baseball. They're number one and number three on the Sox list. They're number 16 and number 34 on the MLB pipeline list. Grant Taylor is a righty who throws a hundo, had four starts at single A last year. He's number seven on the list. See, this is where it gets tricky, because one of the things that Kevin said as he was spraying to all negative fields at once is that some of these young pitchers will blow up. Yes, they will. This is the problem with focusing on young pitchers as they are. It's why you need a lot. You need a big pile of pitchers. A guy left the White Sox game on Friday. What's the name? He pitched on Friday, left the game with elbow discomfort. He's like a top 20 prospect of theirs, maybe a top 30 prospect of theirs who had to leave the game on Friday. The name is escaping me right now.
Is it Mason Adams?
Yeah, Mason Adams. Mason Adams. an arm they love, elbow discomfort. That could be Tommy John in a year. Yeah, I mean, you never know what happens with these guys, and that is the problem. That's why you need a lot of them. But I want to see aggression with some of the position players and with some of those arms too. Because if they're going to pitch until they blow up and they seem to be ready, then let them do it at the big league level and show you the possibilities. And let them work with your big league pitching coaches and such. You know, let them work with the best coaching available, the best training available. We'll keep the conversation going. I'm not asking you to be delusional and buy seashells and balloons. There's actually nuance available in the conversation if you're brave enough to have it. Spiegs with you on Hit and Run on 670 The Score. Connor McKnight at the top of the 11 o'clock hour as we'll continue the White Sox conversation then. But let's go back to the Cubs, what they've looked like in spring, what the methodology seems to be, what the creativity might be with our guy Lance Brozdowski of Marquee. We'll do that next on The Score.
If you're thinking about GLP-1s for weight loss, listen up. You must make sure you're maintaining your muscle mass while you're losing weight. Otherwise, you can slow your metabolism and regain the weight. Omacid, a natural superfood protein shake, has been scientifically proven to preserve muscle mass. It optimizes and supercharges your metabolism so you can lose weight easily. Use Omacid with GLP-1s or as a natural alternative. Find out more and see the university studies at omacid.com. That's AlmaSed.com.
The PGA Tour is all systems go, and so is the new show, Early Wedge, on the CBS Sports Podcast Network. Join Sportsline experts Sia Nejad, Mike McClure, and Eric Cohen alongside myself, Rick Gaiman, Patrick McDonald, and Jason Sobel. Five times per week, the Early Wedge provides the best information for DFS lineups, outright selections, and so much more. Follow and listen to Early Wedge in the Early Edge feed on the Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, we're deeper. I think there's no question. I think, like I said, I knew we were going to have to make some hard decisions, and we're going to probably keep having to make hard decisions as we go. But I feel like, you know, we have a lot of young talent in AAA. So I do think that, you know, when we have the inevitable injuries or inevitable poor performance, I do think that, like, we have some guys that aren't on this trip that are going to play a big role.
Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel, Sundays, 9 a.m. to noon.
They are deeper. Let's talk about this Cubs team, and let's talk a little bit about spring breakout, because it's an exciting time. You got big league games going on in Japan starting on Tuesday, and you've got spring breakout games going on out there in Mesa, and we go to the phone lines to talk to our friend Lance Brozdowski, the player development analyst from Marquee. You can find him right now on the Circa Sports Illinois hotline. Download the Circa app today. Lance, good morning. Happy baseball season, man. How are you?
Speaks, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me, man. How you doing?
I'm very, very good. What did you enjoy the most about the spring breakout games? And for anybody who doesn't know, it's an MLB thing. It's now in year two where they put the very best prospects, the highest ranked prospects, on display for both of the teams in action. It can make for a very fun watch. What did you enjoy the most?
Enjoy that we actually had the game, because we were really excited for this last year and it ended up getting rained out. And then there was supposed to be another spring breakout game with the Cubs against the Dodgers on Thursday. That also got rained out. So just to have the game in the first place, as weird as that sounds, was awesome. So if you want specifics, yeah, I thought Cade Horton off the top looked really good. He threw two innings, K'd a couple guys, struck out notably Christian Moore, who was the first round pick of the Angels from Tennessee. One of the better hitters in the minor leagues. I thought he looked great. I thought his changeup looked great, which is something that I didn't really expect to be saying a couple years ago when he was drafted primarily as like a fastball slider guy. I expect to see him at Wrigley at some point this year. Like, he's going to force the issue if he's as good as he looked yesterday and as good as some people internally have told me that he looks relative to last year.
So now with that changeup looking what it is, are we talking about more depth of possibilities as a starter? And does that change the way Council might actually use him if he has to grab him? Because I was enamored with the idea of Horton in the bullpen in a big role last year before the injury.
Yeah, I would say it depends probably a bit on the starting rotation's health. That's something that's incredibly difficult to predict, I think. There are a lot of options there as to whether there are any options beyond Tyone, Shota, and Steele that you could probably pencil in for like 160-plus. I'd say no. Like, Boyd hasn't thrown that much over the last couple of years. Ben Brown, Jordan Wicks, like, I don't think you could rely on those guys for that big of a chunk. So you run into this situation where I think you got a puzzle piece together, the five, and do it based on who will give you the best per inning performance at various points in the year. And I think at some point you're going to hit, you know, deadline time. We'll see if they make a move there, if they're in it. For a starting pitcher, I could see that being a possibility based on some of the minor league depth they have and potentially some of the arms available. But I think, you know, if they don't make a move or they do it, it's for a smaller piece. There's a point at which you look in August and see that Cade is going to give you the best per inning ratios at that five, better than a guy like Wicks, potentially better than a guy like Brown, better than Ray. And at that point, if you're trying to make a run late, like, you need your best pitchers in there. And I think Cade could do that.
Lance Przedowski from Marquee is with us. I'm so excited to see Council utilize his outgetters here in year two with a full knowledge of everybody and some of the acquisitions that he was a part of acquiring as well. I guess I don't know if I should be cooling my jets on this or not, but I envision some creativity. What do you think are some of the things he might do in terms of using pitchers and doing things in some cutting edge ways? Because he's always been that guy, and I don't know that we saw a ton of it last year as he was kind of getting acclimated to everything.
Yeah, I'm fascinated to see how the bullpen shakes out. I feel like there are a lot of pieces there that project very similarly, have very similar strengths in terms of how they utilize their pitches and in matchup for certain kinds of hitters. And I think that's a good thing, A, because you could say you have depth, but on the other hand, perhaps, you know, at some points this year, it's going to be like, why is he using this guy in this spot? Or like, ooh, that was really sharp of him to use this guy here. Wow, look at this pitcher. We didn't think we're turning to more leverage is now taking innings in the seventh and eighth and looking better than some of the other options. Out of the gate, you know, I think those options are Porter Hodge, Presley, obviously, probably almost exclusively for the ninth, I would imagine. Maybe they flip him into the eighth if they like the matchups better in a game late that's tight. I think Julian Merriweather could hop in there. You know, his changeup's always been really good. I think he's a guy that maybe they could use in kind of sneaky ways versus left-handed hitters in particular. So I'm fascinated to see how that lands. I mean, the dark horses, like, I think Eli Morgan is kind of a sneaky guy because of how good the changeup's been over the last couple of years. I know he gave up a run and a couple of hits in that exhibition game, but again, I'm kind of throwing away a lot of the exhibition game stats. And honestly, I might even throw away some of the regular season Japan stats. I just think it's such a weird environment. We saw some balls hit that were incredibly hard, and, you know, the expected batting averages are crazy on them, and it's like, okay, like, I don't know. We should overanalyze Suzuki hitting balls like 114 that he hasn't done before, et cetera. But back to the bullpen point, like, I think a guy like Morgan is fascinating. Nate Pearson looked really good in that exhibition game. That was a guy that seems to have always underperformed his stuff throughout his entire career with the Blue Jays, and last year was kind of like a fresh start for him. He's fun. He throws hard. There hasn't been a lot of velocity in the pen, so if you really want to dream on a guy maybe taking over the eighth and running with it, it's probably him. I still want something there beyond the fastball and slider. I think he needs some kind of split or something. That would make him much more impenetrable versus his left-handed hitters as well. So,
oh, God.
There's a lot here, man. It's a puzzle.
Yeah, it is. But I just, underperforming his stuff. God, that's so, yeah. It's so baseball. And it's so,
it is.
So many arms are great and the stuff looks great. And even, you know, my buddy Eno Saris with his stuff plus, yeah. So, like, he'll admit that, like, and yet it doesn't translate into production. And what is it? It's, why do people underperform their stuff? Why in your mind does it happen as often as it does?
I think it's a combination of a lot of soft skills. Like I love stuff plus. I use it a lot. Like, I think it's a great tool. We're essentially talking about, like, the combination of traits of a pitch. So how far is he throwing it?
Yep.
What slots he throwing it from? How does it move? And how can we grade that out historically based on prior pitches? Like, okay, this guy's throwing this. We've seen this for the last 3 years, and this is the performance, and this is how we expect it to be. That's what Stuff Plus is. I think for the most part, what you run into is, like, I view Stuff Plus almost as like a potential number. I think initially when it first came out and how it's currently marketed is more like a catch-all stat, like an ERA or any of those other fun ERA indicators or something along those lines. Whereas, like, I view it like, okay, if your Stuff Plus is high, like, you have the potential to be good, but although, like, it may align in certain situations, like, Derek Crochet, Paul Skeens, like, yeah, they have great stuff plus and they're great pitchers. But you have a boatload of other guys that have good stuff and cannot get results. You also have a boatload of guys who have average stuff, average locations, and have long track records of results. You know? So it's like that is kind of the crux of stuff plus. It's like it's one of the tools. And so whether you're using it as your only tool,
yeah.
Like, we do not have to do that. I feel like we often get caught up. Someone's like, what's the best stat to look at? You know, give me one stat. It's like, listen, we have like 40. Like, I will tell you three or four that I think paint a good picture, but I don't need to give you one because we got 40 of them. So I always find it funny when we try to, like, reduce and simplify. But to your point about why guys underperform, sequencing, I think location is a big thing. There's also, like, I think that it could capture, like, release traits and how a guy looks at getting to his release point. But sometimes things that happen in a pitcher's body before that point can be what you say, quote-unquote, deceptive. And that's where you run into the guys who have low stuff but overperform. I think to some extent Steele's like that. Like, he hasn't ever graded exceptionally well, but he's been more in the average sphere. And I think as they've done stuff plus updates, he's jumped up. But he's got results, man. Like, last 3 years, he's one of the best pitchers in baseball. We know his cut fastball is a weird pitch. You know, he's starting to develop the changeup. The slider's always been good, but no one's ever kind of bet on that fastball shape and been like, this will get you a sub-3.5 ERA for 3 years in a row. Mm. And he's done it. So what is going on in Steele's body? How does he look to hitters? That stuff is just stuff I don't think you're going to be able to capture in Stuff Plus.
Oh, man, it's so true. Steele is one of those guys who's just so dominant and effective at times because of his ability to slightly change speed, slightly change location, just mess with people's timing. Steele ends up being a great guy for this conversation, which, of course, Lance, is where you and I usually end up, which is this kind of existential debate about pitching. Because I always think of Warren Spahn as spouted by Greg Maddux, as like relearned by some of us with Kyle Hendricks here, which is that hitting is timing and pitching is upsetting timing. And like, if you are not Paul Skeens, if you are not those guys with the elite stuff, if you're one of those guys who's just a little bit below, you're not going to dominate. You're not just going to dominate. So you can't just rear back and be like, here's my slider, which is great. Now here's my fastball, which is great. You have to use timing. You have to use deception. You have to use all that other stuff because that's what can separate you from the myriad other dudes who have the almost exact same caliber stuff as you. You're not Skeens. Stop trying to be Skeens.
I think you're spot on. I think this is, you can illustrate this in like a larger trend that I think is going to happen this year. It's more of a subtle one. Like, everyone's trying to figure out like what's the next pitch and like the kick changeup, et cetera. I think this year what we're going to get is if you look at like the top 100 or so starting pitchers every single season and look at how many pitches they throw more than, let's say, like 5% of the time or so. So not a pitch that he throws in one game, but one that's like in his repertoire enough to be categorized as like his own pitch. Each of the last two seasons, that ratio has jumped up. I think it's gone from about 4.5 pitches to, let's say, like 4.75 pitches. I think this is the year it jumps above five, where you get a clear delineation where everyone is realizing you need diversity of mix. And honestly, with how far pitch design and optimization of seam orientation and all these really fancy things we could talk about for ages has become so ubiquitous in multiple organizations, and honestly, at this point, probably the majority of organizations, it's becoming very easy to add good pitches very quickly. And as a result of that, you look at how to match up with hitters, and I just think a lot of these guys are going to be like, hey, I don't have something arm side to this lefty. Like, I'm trying to go fastball up, cutter in, slider down in. It's like, cool, now we have these four orientations on a changeup. You previously haven't been able to throw one. Now you can. And then you look at that and go, wow, like, oh, I actually feel good with it. I can command it. And now all of a sudden I have a fourth pitch to lefties and now six in my repertoire because I also have these two other pitches to righties. That is what I think we're going to see a lot more of this year. And that's like one of my subtle predictions is like, I call it the year of the mix, but I really think like there's going to be a lot more pitchers throwing like five, six, upwards of seven pitches. And guys who don't even need them adding them. You see Paul Skenes this spring, right? He added a cutter and he added a sinker. Or a true, like, he's calling it more of a two-seam. He's already got that weird splinker thing.
Right.
But he's got, like, six, seven pitches now. It's like, if Paul Skenes just did what he did last year, he's probably still winning the Cy Young. Now he adds two more pitches. It's like, if that's a wake-up call for anyone throwing, like, two or three pitches as a starter. And there's very few of them. But I see even guys who are throwing four. Like, you're looking at the best pitcher in baseball, and he just added two more pitches. It's like, there's probably room for you to add something, regardless of whether you want to, like, say you're comfortable with them and how it affects the rest of your mix. Like, the best pitchers in baseball are all adding things. And you as a pitcher who's throwing three or four probably needs another pitch.
Well, that would make it a lot more fun. That really would make it a lot more fun. We're with Lance Brzdowski from Marquee over here on Hit and Run on 670 The Score. It speaks here with you. Connor McKnight from CHSN will join us at the top of the hour. All right, let's go to the offense. I'm trying to figure out how to elucidate this point, and maybe you can help me. I feel like the quality of at-bats on the entirety of this Cubs roster is going to be at such a higher floor all the way down to the bottom of the roster, whether it's Gage Workman right now, who will give you good at-bats, you know, or whether that's going to be a spot that Nico Horner takes over, or even like the John Birdies of the world. Like, these are no longer Miles Mastroboni at-bats. They're no longer Nick Madrigal at-bats, you know? So, like, the quality of the at-bats from top to bottom is going to be such that it'll raise the floor of consistency for this offense, and that is going to have an effect of more innings where the line keeps moving, of more innings where the possibilities are there, more balls in play, more solid approaches, and that runs will come with that and wins will come with that too. I don't know how to quantify it, but it's just a feeling I'm having. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I think I agree. I think that is like the strength of this team. Like, you look at adding Justin Turner, I think Workman's a really interesting bat, even if the strikeout rate's high. You know, Birdie will put together a decent at-bat too, but again, that's just a fill-in to get Horner back for the most part. Like, Shaw, I think your two variables here that I'm most fascinated by, and Tucker becoming in his lineup is just so massive. But for me, is how does Shaw do off the top, right? If you look at some of his AAA statistics, he wasn't particularly good versus right-handed sliders or right-handed sweep of any kind. He's a fastball hitter. He's shown this through the minors. I'm fascinated to see how he does versus major league sliders, guys who can locate them, et cetera. That, I'm always going to bring this up whenever I talk about minor league hitters, but the gap of pitching between AAA and the majors is larger than it's ever been. I had some people tell me that it's like upwards of two levels of difference. So if there was a between AAA level, that would actually be appropriate for guys adjusting. As a result of that, when guys get to the majors, sometimes they're overwhelmed. I would say even most often over the last couple of years, we've seen a lot of these top prospects come up and get overwhelmed. And it comes down to the fact that these guys got to adjust. And everyone in the Cubs org will tell you that Shaw is like an A-plus adjuster. And that is probably the skill you need to be able to take a month of ABs versus major league pitching and go, okay, I now understand how to either lay off this slider or do something with it to force him to come back in and throw more fastball against me that I can hit. That is like the variable here. So, you know, he's hitting, what did he hit? He hit 5th the other day, or he hit 5th this morning.
Yeah.
Over in Japan in the exhibition game.
This morning.
Like, that's a fascinating spot lineup for me. Like, they got some confidence if they're opening, they're rolling that guy out there 5th. You know, like, I don't know how many other guys are debuting and batting 5th. And then Dansby Swanson is my other one. He last year slugged under 400 for the first time, and I think since 2018. Sure, maybe it was a byproduct of Wrigley crushing right-handed power from a win perspective. But, you know, in spring he said he'd been injured for like the last year and a half or so, which was kind of a revelation for me. He had surgery in the offseason and stuff. Like, there's a lot of stuff here that I think that he is like a key cog in this, where if he is above 400 slug again, looks like, say, 2017 version of himself, and that's further back, but I'll even take like 2021, 2022 Dansby Swanson, where he's, you know, able to get over 20 homers. You know, everything looks good from a baseline perspective. He's not league average hitter. He's more like 10%, 15% above league average. That, to me, is a massive swing in this lineup. To be able to have Sean Swanson kind of in that 5-6-7 area that are actually giving you above major league average production.
No, it's
that
good.
Is like the key point for me.
That's a good call. All right, last thing for you, Lance. We appreciate the time. Really loved watching Kevin Alcantara when I was out there, and I've loved watching him in general. It's interesting because he homered last night on an inside pitch, seemed to take his hands back, and but he's not a big power guy historically in terms of production. I don't think he's ever had more than 15 homers in a complete minor league year at whatever level. But boy, he hits the ball with authority the other way, and obviously the tools are there. It's an interesting profile, isn't it? What do you think about Alcantara, and do you think he's a part of the mix this year for the Cubs?
Yeah, I mean, the key thing with his profile that I think is slightly underrated is that he's actually a pretty good defender overall. And you know, we saw this with Pete Carr Armstrong, but the ability to like play somewhere defensively as a prospect gives you like a floor of playing time to be able to figure out what I was talking about on the hitting side. That's why I think like it was so valuable for Pete to be a plus glove, because they forced him into the lineup. They let him struggle for periods of time, and he's had time to figure it out. The tough part, I think, on the prospect side is like when you don't have that defensive carrying tool, and it's like, okay, we need to get him ABs, but like we're not totally confident with him at any spot in the field, such that like now he's only getting 2-3 ABs a game. We're not letting him play the full nine. Like that is, I think, somewhat detrimental. Alcantara doesn't have that problem because he can play good outfield. The thing with him in the minor leagues and et cetera that I think is causing maybe some of the actualization of power to fall behind, he gets the ball on the ground a lot. I wouldn't say his swing's grooved, but he is more of that like ground ball contact style guy. And this is partially why maybe some of his exit velocities are inflated, because you're going to run into higher exit velocities the more you're pounding things into the ground. But like, if he can get to, I'm not even saying like it's very in vogue to just say, you know, hit the ball hard in the air. Like, sure, that's an idea that he could probably pursue and be a better hitter. I just want even like some line drives, you know. And he does this at times. But if you look at a lot of like the aggregated data from AAA for him, there's a lot of ground ball contact, and I think that is why you're looking at more subtle home run totals. Whereas like if he could pull that up a little bit and be more of like even if he's below average in ground ball rate in the league, like even if he's more towards the average, I think that could make his offensive profile a lot more tolerable. But overall, I mean, the approach is good. Hits the ball hard. Like the tools are there for him to be a really exceptional player. And I think if there's any situation where they need some kind of outfielder this year, he's the guy to bring up and slot in, because you're going to be confident defensively. Even if you bat him 8-9, you give him some time to figure it out. Next thing you know, we could be talking about next year him being a much higher floor from an offensive perspective.
Lance Przedowski, thanks for waking up, man. Appreciate you. Have a great season, and we'll be talking.
Always. Thanks, Peace.
All right, buddy. That's Lance Przedowski from Marquee. Top of the hour, Connor McKnight will do White Sox with us. When we come back, the most indelible moment of things that I was able to see in Mesa when I was out there for 3 days and did a couple of games for the Cubs Radio Network, there's one moment that just kind of won't leave my head that I need to share it with you. And it regards a guy who has had the best viral moment from Japan so far of anybody on the Cubs, in my opinion. We'll talk about all that next here on The Score.
The thing you learn quickly about being around Justin is that he has a very advanced feel for the game. I mean, he is just seeing things. He's kind of seeing things before most guys are seeing them. Now, that doesn't have anything to do with going 2-for-2 yesterday. But that's what is kind of one of his great tools is, frankly, is just how he's able to see the game. And I think it probably in the end, it's one of those things that allows him to make adjustments quicker during the season. No, it's fun to watch him hit. It's a little different, right? It looks a little different the way he kind of stands up there, and but he's clearly got, you know, really good. He's worked really hard at creating a wonderful bat path, and he's got good strike zones of discipline, and it adds up to being a good offensive player.
The premier baseball show in Chicago, Hit and Run with Matt Spiegel.
Boy, that's great stuff from Craig Counsell on Justin Turner. Justin Turner is one of the more interesting big league development stories the last 10, 15 years. You know, a prospect who didn't really pan out with the Mets
and then goes to the Dodgers and finds something. And maybe you remember when David Bodie was starting to show some possibilities here, that people around the Cubs were like, oh, maybe he can do what Justin Turner did. Maybe he can do what Justin Turner did is a sentence that was uttered in a lot of organizations for a several-year period there in the middle of the 2010s and beyond, because he found a way to make his contact point in front of the plate more than it was when he was with the Mets. And yes, he used a little bit more of a launch angle, but it was more about the contact point. It was a change in his bat path, like Craig Counsell just said, and he revolutionized his career. Look at his career. Look at the numbers that all of a sudden started happening in LA, and they continued. And he showed the ability to hit for power, but then also hit for contact with two strikes to still be able to go the other way and be that contact guy that he was, but be a little bit more aggressive. Frankly, it's similar to what Jose Bautista figured out in Toronto with the hitting coach Dwayne Murphy. It's more similar to that than it is to anything else. So anyway, Turner is a great success story. I'd always known that part of him. What I didn't know is that he's a great dude, like a great teammate, a willing teacher and helper. And the moment that I have not been able to stop thinking about from my time in Mesa is like Turner got introduced to the media and the players one day. And then the next day, and I wasn't there for that, but the next day was his first day in the clubhouse, and I was there for that. Hey, there's Justin Turner. Media goes over, says hello. I go over, introduce myself. We have a great, fun little conversation, whatever. And then I see him grabbing a bag of bats and walking out of the clubhouse very early. And what he was doing was walking over to the ballpark for batting practice. But here's who was at this batting practice session. The hitting coach, Dustin Kelly, Justin Turner, and Dansby Swanson. That's it. Dansby Swanson was taking pitches from Dustin Kelly with the pitching machine, and Dustin Kelly, the hitting coach, was letting Justin Turner do 100% of the talking to Dansby Swanson. Dansby Swanson, veteran, listening to Justin Turner, real uber veteran, 40-year-old, who's a badass. And if he can help reach Dansby Swanson and help him figure out some ways to maximize the rest of his career, Dansby's open to that. And that would be a very, very good and healthy thing. And sometimes guys will listen to a veteran player more than they will listen to a hitting coach. They will take that input from a dude who has been there and done that. And Turner is definitely that. So I haven't been able to stop thinking about that moment. I hope he has a real good effect on Dansby. Hope he has a good effect on others. I think a guy like Nico Horner can look at Justin Turner and think, well, I've got the contact skills. If I can add the home run power on pitches one and two or strikes one and two before I go back to my contact self with two strikes, maybe I can have the kind of career that Justin Turner has had. So I'll be interested to see all of that. And then there was what happened today. So I think the most viral moment so far from the Cubs in Japan, at least today, is Justin Turner seeing two Japanese kids with long red beards, not real beards, right, Robbie? Can you confirm they were not actual beards?
Yeah, correct. They were about like 8 or 9, so that'd be really difficult to grow those beards.
Maybe even younger. I'm going to say one of them might have been 5 or 6. One of them might have been 8 or 9. Are they actual Justin Turner fans? I don't know. Are their parents Justin Turner fans? Maybe. Were they wearing strap-on beards? Ooh, kinky. No kink shaming on Hit and Run on a Sunday morning. They were strap-on beards that they were wearing, and Turner saw them and walked over to where they were in the stands and said, come here, come here, come on, come here. And it was right behind a photo well. And the photographers are like, really? You want them to come here? Okay. And he made them open the door of the photo well, and the kids came down, and then he grabbed the kid and put him in his arms, and they took pictures together. The kids with their Justin Turner fake beards and Justin Turner with his real beard, which is a lot shorter than it used to be. But anyway, he went over and made the most of the moment. It was really cool. See Japanese kids with long red beards. Now, not only Japanese kids, but Japanese adults. Long red beards, not very popular in Japan. I don't see them a lot. Frankly, I don't know if they're genetically popular. I don't want to, you know, talk, get out over my skis in talking about different cultures and races and what is genetically possible. These days, you can do anything, folks. But haven't seen a lot of long red beards on Japanese guys is all I'm saying. But Justin Turner doesn't care. He made a moment out of it, and it was really cool. He was wearing the kimono the other night. You see how he was so pleased to be in the kimono? He was gifted the yukata robe when the team arrived for their Tokyo series, and there he is with a big S-eating grin wearing the kimono. They're having a good time over there. It's all adding up to just horrific FOMO, just problematic, painful FOMO for your boy
now. What would be the first thing you would do if you were in Japan with them? What would be the first thing, the bucket list thing that Speaks would do?
What, if I was there with the ball club in Japan? I mean...
Is there a cuisine? Is there a place?
I mean, of course, like when the omakase, like... I mean, both of the meals that Alex Cohen described, like the high-end omakase, I can't imagine how good it is in Japan. I've never been. And just the low-end street food dumpling, like, oh yeah, hell yeah.
That's the thing.
Oh,
give me that greasy street food right there.
Greasy Tokyo street food for the win. Let's go. But I'd also want to find like some kind of like underground poker den, like some secret poker den. I want to chase the secretive awesome hang. But also like I want to go find a Zen garden so I can meditate somewhere on a beautiful afternoon. I got a lot of things I want
to
do.
Those are some very polar opposites. Go to the poker game at Reek of Sigs and go to the Zen garden. That's I kind of love that.
That's me, baby. I'm your boy right there on display. It's Matt Spiegler with you on a Sunday morning doing Hit and Run. One more hour to go. The phone lines will be open next hour for you. We'll do Team of the Moment in our final segment. But coming up next, Connor McKnight from CHSN. Been a long time since we talked to Connor on the air. We'll see how that goes. I think it's going to go well, but you can find out by sticking around on The Score.